This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about speaking up with Paul Gilmartin. And it's a very special interview for me as a chance to interview a fellow podcaster who is very well known within the mental health space. And also, although we didn't plan it this way, it's worked out quite nicely with the episode order that last week it was silence and this week it's speaking up.
Yeah.
The first stat I've got is from Time to Change, which is one we reference a lot, having worked a lot with them. Although, sadly, during the pandemic, they are one of the campaigns that has lost its funding. They found for most people who experience mental ill health, a bigger factor at this point is the stigma, even more so than the symptoms. So not for everyone, but they find in their research and surveys, it's the stigma that holds people back from getting the help they need or speaking up or feeling accepted or accepting their own condition. That can often be the bigger barrier than the symptoms, which even though I'm very familiar with that stat, it still continues to shock me. It's just massive and really hammers home why we do what we do.
Yeah, I think that the fact that the pandemic has brought about so much more conversations around mental health and the impact, and people are more aware, it's also made it quite difficult and challenging at times for those conversations to always be authentic. I mean, I was listening the other day to a colleague talking, and they were sharing an experience about the leadership team saying, so many people now since this pandemic going on about their mental health and saying that they need time off work, and it's just becoming, you know, all, you know, a constant thing now. And, you know, hearing that just perpetuates the stigma, people wanting to come forward and talk about their experiences. So, yeah, it's almost like that word stress that used to carry so much weight, you know, like, oh, they're off with stress. Oh, and then we were kind of more sensitive to it, and we started to understand that, look, this is a real thing and we need to be more sensitive to it from an organisational point of view. And now it's almost like we're hearing that at times more and more now with regard to mental health as a wider term. So, yeah, I'm not surprised by that statistic at all.
Well, that is ultimately the stigma pushing back on progress, unfortunately, that when we get more conversations about it, it often is the people with certain limited views of mental health that are then like, oh, everyone's talking about it. And if we continue to struggle with that element of it, it holds us back of having the deeper conversations of what are the societal factors contributing to mental ill health? What are the ways we can improve language? Suicide is obviously an example that we've used before. That's one where the battle is so just normalizing that conversation that there's oftentimes not space to talk about, you know, the terminology and the way people talk about it, because we're still struggling to get the conversation out there at all. And that's really tricky. And so one of the things the guest talks about today, which really links to this theme and is something that so many people struggle to speak up about, is what's known as covert incest. This is a term that I've not been that familiar with, and it's one that is often overlooked and misunderstood. And so whilst it's quite a nuanced experience and difficult to get a succinct definition on, the best way I'd describe it with my research and what I've read up, this is a type of emotional abuse whereby the child's boundaries and privacy and other parts of their safety are violated by an adult, but it does not include any sexual contact. And that is part of why this is so often overlooked, misunderstood, and the word covert is used. This is a term specifically for all the stuff that isn't the physical. It's a difficult thing to succinctly define, but our guest has actually quite a typical experience of this. So he does a really good job of explaining his experience in a way that's very vulnerable, very honest. And like I said, it's something that so few people understand and so few people feel able to speak up about. It's really powerful to hear.
Yeah, covert incest. It's just something that, although I believe, well, I know I've seen and worked around it, and I'm aware of inappropriate language, behaviour, communication between parent and child, the term is something that I am unfamiliar with and don't have much experience with regard to the language. And I think that's absolutely why it obviously goes under the radar so often. You know, so many people must be experiencing this and not really know how to call it out. And I include professionals when I say that. How does it even become something that's noticed? Yeah, I mean, it's an emotional, really important to start having these conversations. So, you know, it's great that the guest today was open to share his experiences.
And so one thing actually I wanted to bring up that references this, not directly, but as a more general point about language. The listeners know that language is very important to me. It's very important when we try and work to end stigma. It's very important when talking about mental health and very sensitive issues like this appropriately. And I'm of the strong belief that our media has a lot to do with that in terms of perpetuating what is the appropriate and correct way to talk about certain topics. And so particularly when talking about child abuse, it is very wrongly reported, and particularly the sensationalization and the headlines that we see where they're trying to distill a topic down in an attention-grabbing way can be prioritized over treating stories with understanding and treating victims with respect. It's emotive. It may not be easy to hear us talk about these kind of topics, but it is so important that these are talked about correctly. This has been something on my mind for a long time. And once you start looking out for this, you will see it everywhere. The misreporting is so pervasive, and I do what I can in terms of writing complaints, in terms of raising awareness, but I thought it was really important for me to speak about on the show. And at the core of all of this is the victim. And I think the least we can demand is that these stories are handled appropriately. And that's something we always try to do here at Mental, something we hold ourselves to very high standards about. And it's also really important because, like our guest, so often lack of understanding and misrepresentation, misuse of language can lead to victims of child abuse believing it's their fault. That is often an experience of the abuse, that you feel it's your fault. And even at one point in the interview, our guest says that there were times when he thought it was his fault, that what was happening to him was his fault, and that his feelings about it being inappropriate were his fault. So if I went back to that interview now, I remember at this point that what I was going to follow up on is saying that it's not his fault, and that it is so common that people think that, whatever type of abuse it is, in the broadest possible way, that is so common when it comes to abuse of any kind. And so I'm so grateful that our guest shared this story. It may also be worth mentioning he has a background as a comic. So as much as we're focusing here on the intro, on the heaviest parts of this interview, there are also lighter moments. And he's a very warm and lovely character who the listeners may recognise from the podcast, The Mental Illness Happy Hour. So that is a podcast in the States, which has been going for many years now, where they talk very openly, very honestly about mental health, including sharing the experiences of their listeners and guests that he interviews. So this is quite a notable collaboration for us, for me to get to work with somebody that I so respect the work from, and that many of our listeners, no doubt, will listen to both podcasts. Hopefully we'll get to work with him more. So is there anything else you wanted to add with that, Danielle?
Well, I think you've summed it up brilliantly there, Bobby. You speak really strongly and passionately about this, and absolutely it's valid. And you're right, at Mental work so hard to ensure that we use appropriate language and that we're sensitive to all of the topics and stories that we hear and that we discuss. And the media have a huge part to play in this, absolutely, when it comes to sexual abuse and also mental health and racism and all of the other topics that are really at the forefront of our conversations at the moment. And the language that they use is so powerful that it's so important that they work to get this right for the sake of everybody involved. So I don't need to say any more about that. You made a really good point there. Great place to start in, as even having these conversations, because it's just not something that I've delved into at all, and it is an emotional subject and really, really painful and impactful for the people that are experiencing it. So absolutely, I'm excited about this interview.
For sure. And it is difficult to talk about. It is. I find myself getting emotional talking about this topic. And so, you know, particularly I wanted to speak up about that point on the reporting. And the last thing I'll mention on this is by the time the listeners hear this episode, many of you will have watched the Meghan, Harry and Oprah interview. And of course, mental health came up a lot in that conversation. And so we're really interested to hear from you what your thoughts were on that, how you felt it was conducted in terms of the interview, but also the reporting around it obviously has been very mixed. And if you want us to talk about it, then let us know. You can tweet me at Bobby Temps. You can DM us at Mental Podcast. You can drop us an email via our website. Let us know any thoughts you had about that interview. For now, let's get into this episode with Paul Gilmartin. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
My name is Paul Gilmartin, and I think the first time I remember having an issue with my mind or my feelings was being around 8 or 9 years old, and I was pitching in a baseball game, which you would think would be something that a kid who loves baseball would be completely invested in and present. And I just felt this deadness in my soul. And as I'm on the mound, you know, waiting to pitch to the next guy, I was just thinking, trying to find something in my life that I could look forward to. And I thought, this is how old I am. I thought, oh, later tonight, we're going to go see the Poseidon Adventure. I'm excited at the thought of seeing that. And that kind of jolted me out of my malaise. And really kind of ever since then, I've been aware of this battle of the darkness kind of sucking the joy out of my life. Not always, but yeah, so I think that was the first time.
I have something similar in that I remember from a very young age, consciously seeming happy. Not an ability to be able to change it, but a keenness to come across a certain way because I knew the uncomfortable emotions, or so they seemed to the adults around me, the uncomfortable emotions made others uncomfortable. And so if I didn't have a good reason for them, they're best just hidden away.
It's so damaging to a child. I mean, it's obvious, but teaching a kid to bottle their emotions is just a recipe for struggle for them for probably a lifetime. I mean, we can certainly rewire our brain and there's therapy and fellowship and support groups and all of that, but it takes so much work to begin to understand what you're even feeling when you're raised focusing on who do I need to be in this moment so everyone's happy. You get so disconnected from your body. I didn't really start to re-inhabit my body until probably my 50s.
Well, but you're right. It's very common when your focus becomes so external like that, you can almost become better at understanding other people's emotions and your own becomes secondary.
And I think I probably wouldn't do the podcast if I hadn't had that experience of being kind of other focused, having to be an empath, not by choice, but because my mom treated me like I was her therapist. And that's not to say I haven't, you know, I don't have a history of treating people like shit and being inconsiderate, because I certainly do. But there's always been that part of me that worries about what other people are feeling, that I am uncomfortable if other people are uncomfortable.
Right. And what you mentioned there at the start about racking your brain for something to look forward to, was that something that you found yourself doing a lot?
Well, I had so many distractions when I was young. And, you know, I lived in a nice area that had woods and I had friends. So there was, if you had even the least bit of imagination and loved the outdoors, it was a great place to be raised. But I think by the time I got to be in high school, I was feeling like the world was kind of passing me by. My group of friends had decided to stay with Catholic school and go to the Catholic high school. I decided I was tired of wearing uniforms and I wanted to go to the public high school. So I went from being a popular kid in a class of 40 people to an unknown kid that was still years away from puberty in a class of 1,300 kids. That was just my freshman class. That's how big the school was. So I felt like I had just been lost at sea. And so the summer after my freshman year, when I discovered weed and alcohol, that kind of became my band-aid for that feeling of something inside me missing. And I didn't realize until I got sober years later, you know, at age 40, that while some of it was mental and emotional, and there were certainly scars from childhood, a big part of it was not being of service to people and not having much of a spiritual life, not in terms of worship, you know, we're going to church, but in terms of saying, hey, how can I make the world a better place instead of where's mine? You know, I want more money. I want more recognition.
I see that. And I think it's so difficult, particularly when you've got experience of depression. It's something that, like many mental illnesses, drags your attention inward. And yet at the same time is telling you how wrong you are for that. And It kind of traps you in this state of, okay, I've got to do a certain amount of focus in order to survive this and get up and out of bed every day. But also I'm selfish and I hate myself for it.
Yes. Yeah. The shame nap. That's how many times I have taken it, you know, throw in some perfectionism in there as well, which then brings about the dread of even doing things that should be enjoyable, you know, going out in the garage and woodworking. A lot of times just the fear of making a mistake and ruining a beautiful piece of wood, I'll just get so anxious, I'll become exhausted and have to go lay down. And I mean, it's, as I say it out loud, it sounds ridiculous, but one of my earliest memories was coloring using the wrong crayon on a thing I was coloring in kindergarten and suddenly realizing my mistake and being inconsolable. And the teacher almost like laughing, like saying, it's okay. It's okay. It's not a big deal. I could not be consoled. To me, it was the end of the world that I'd made a mistake. And I don't know where that comes from, but I will probably always have a little bit of that in me, but support groups and stuff like that have helped me at least become more aware of it, that my value is not attached to how well I do things, that we all just innately have value because we are human beings and we are alive.
For sure. I love that. But it's interesting to me how these kind of patterns can come up of maladaptive ways of dealing with life. And I often can't draw the line between where it relates to your mental health and where it doesn't. But it seems that either way in this situation, it kind of backs up the depression for you. It almost, you see these maladaptive behaviors and they almost become convenient for the mental illness. So, you know, if you have that perfectionism, then it means that most of the time, by that impossible standard, you are failing. And if you already feel like you're a failure, well then, okay, it's horrible, but at least it's compatible with my way of thinking.
There's so much momentum to mental illness and also so much momentum to recovery. For me, it's very much like going to the gym. When I stop going to the gym, I don't feel like going to the gym. But when I'm going to the gym, my body feels better and it doesn't seem so hard to go to the gym. And same with mental illness. When I'm in a good place, I just have more resilience. But when I get to that place and everything begins to seem like too much, then, you know, like you talked about, it's, I can't get out of bed. Well, then I hate myself even more. Well, now I'm even more depressed. Mm. You know, throw some alcohol into it and, you know, it's just gasoline on the fire. But, you know, fortunately, I got sober about 17 years ago. That was the first step that I needed to take to have a chance of staying alive.
Do you mind sharing a little bit more about that and your experiences growing up?
Sure. My mom did not have a lot of boundaries. She grew up abandoned emotionally in a lot of ways by both her mom and her dad. Her dad physically abandoned her, but her mother was a pretty cold woman who left her to be raised by relatives. And so I imagine she was probably in survival mode for love her whole life. And the kind of the metaphor that I have for my mom is she's a cactus that just wants a hug. Oh. And I had to cut contact with her about 8 years ago because it was just not healthy for me. She was inappropriate. There's a term called covert incest, which is probably the most accurate way I could describe the things that she did when I was a kid growing up. She took my temperature rectally till I was 8 years old. And, you know, was asking her, why are we still doing it this way? She didn't do it with my brother. You know, I would be chided if, you know, I didn't want to be unclothed around her. She would, you know, make it seem like I was the one that had the problem. There was a lot of, you know, grabbing me and touching me like I were her date or her husband, and treating me like her therapist, you know, crying to me about her marriage when I was 8, you know. So there was just a sense that it's not safe, that she was not safe, and that I needed to take care of her. And so I think that became my template for how I viewed relationships for people moving forward, especially women. So for me, I think there was anger and resentment subconsciously at women. So I was a pig. I was a womanizer. And I'm not laying the responsibility of that on my mom. I'm just saying that that's how I reacted to, I suppose, what I couldn't handle mentally and emotionally. And I didn't know that there was the kind of help that there is now that I know. And I started going to support groups. Well, I was probably about 7 years sober, off drugs and alcohol. But that's this other support group that deals with fear of intimacy and childhood abandonment and sexual inappropriateness and all the kind of stuff I experienced. That's where I really began to address the core issues that were just causing me so much challenge.
Right. I can see that. And when I've heard you share about this before, one of the things that's moved me the most is you talking about feeling objectified, and no child is equipped to understand that, you know, to deal with that emotionally. And so many of the other things you experienced, your home should be a safe space, and it wasn't. So I see what you're saying of, you know, absolutely, there are ways where at a certain point in our life, it's time to take responsibility and own the issues that we have for ourselves and how we deal with them. But at the same time, I can see the sort of through line of maybe because of the total lack of control in that situation, it may lead you to go really far the other way with then relationships of your own of how can I really dominate and leave the person I'm with actually feeling quite unstable and unsafe, maybe in the way that I have.
I was definitely a bad husband. I was cold. I was unfaithful. A lot of things that I'm ashamed of. I wish I hadn't been those things. And I'd like to think I'm a different person today. I'm no longer married, but my ex-wife and I are friendly with each other. But it's taken a lot of work to bring my walls down, to be able to be in a relationship with a woman and not feel overwhelmed by her needs. I grew up with a very, very, very needy mother without boundaries, and it just felt so overwhelming. And so one of the tools that I used before I used drugs and alcohol was fantasy and shutting down. And so in my marriage, I would just shut down when I would get uncomfortable. I wouldn't want to talk about anything because to talk about things when I was a child in my family was to just expand the, you know, the sense of helplessness and to feel overwhelmed. It was just better to just keep your head down, pretend you're listening, and wait until the first moment you can leave the room. And that is no way to be a husband or a partner. So I've had to really work to not be that guy anymore. Sometimes actually just the other night, my girlfriend said to me, "Are you okay?" And I said, "I don't know." And I had to sit and think about it. And I tested positive for the marker for rheumatoid arthritis a couple of weeks ago. And it has explained a lot of the joint pain and skin issues that I've had. So while it's nice to know finally what it is that I have, it's also, you know, it's an autoimmune disease that is progressive and there's no cure for it. And I've had to completely give up foods that I love. And kind of like what you were talking about with, I'm just going to put on a brave face. I've been trying to look for the positives, and there are positives, but I also hadn't really let myself be sad about the fact that I can't eat deep dish pizza or ice cream or bread or a lot of things that I love. And it took my girlfriend asking, are you okay? For me to have to stop and go, what am I feeling right now? And I realized, I said, I think I'm sad. And I started to cry, you know, as much as somebody who's dead inside can cry. And I'm not dead inside, but as I do have trouble crying sometimes because I think my default state is always slightly numb. And I thanked her for asking me because I need support. I will need support for the rest of my life to help me understand how to do life.
Right. And I think even that numbness you've described is so often a survival in itself. Do you think it's fair to say that what you learned from a lot of your early experiences was that emotions and intimacy were inherently unsafe?
Absolutely, 100%. And to not expect anything from people. You know, I have had relationships with people where I look back at them now and I'm just like, that person was such a user. Why was I friends with that person? There was nothing emotionally satisfying about that relationship with that person. It was always all about them. I was always doing something for them. I wasn't even aware of that. And I think it's because I expect so little from people. I was playing roller hockey years ago with a group of people that I've probably only known for about a year. I just happened upon them in a park one day. And so we started playing roller hockey 3 days a week. And one day, the two of the women that were regulars there, I guess they knew it was my birthday, and they brought me a little cake and I started to cry. Well, I should say I got choked up. I certainly wouldn't have wanted to cry in front of them, but I remember like welling up, being just shocked that somebody would see me like that, that they would care enough to do that for me. And I remember thinking, what the fuck does that come from? Why is this touching me so deeply? And I think it's because there's always this level of numbness. I mean, a great example of the numbness is when my dad tried to kill himself. I think I was about 30 years old. When I got the news, I actually don't know if I ever even cried. I wasn't surprised. My dad was somebody that I knew had demons. He was an isolator. He had no friends. He was a closet alcoholic, high functioning, but I could just see the childhood wound in him. Like I could see the childhood wound in my mom. I remember feeling sorry for my parents when I was like 7 or 8, that there was something kind of broken in them that they couldn't see in themselves. And I just remember wondering why I wasn't feeling anything about my dad trying to take his life. And when I did get a hold of him on the phone, he'd been committed to Bellevue in New York because he was out of town on business. And when I did, after 2 days, not being able to talk to him, got on the phone with him, I said, you know, Dad, it's Paul. How are you? And he went, oh, fine. And my heart just sank because I was like, oh my God, he's so out of touch, in such denial. And in many ways, I think I'm cut from the same mold where it takes a lot for me to understand what the fuck is going on inside me.
And it's something that I think I can see in a lot of your work and your podcasting at times. The one thing you're so incredible at doing is empathizing with other people's experiences, right? So if aren't familiar with your show already, you have these listener surveys that people submit. And, you know, some of them I hear and I have to pause the podcast for a moment just to take it in because they're so emotive. And also there are some that are lighthearted. But what you're brilliant at doing is pausing in that and acknowledge the depth of people's feelings and somehow think of something to say. I think that's so incredible. And yet, in contrast, at times when you're talking about your own experiences, you share such pure insights and raw honesty, and then a joke comes out of nowhere and lifts you back up out of it.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And I don't know where it comes from. I do know when I'm reading the survey, I imagine the person who filled it out listening, because I know how incredibly validating it can be for somebody to witness your pain and to tell you you're not making too big of a deal. In fact, if anything, you're minimizing this and I want to hug you. You know, there's a part of me that, you know, if you could reach through a computer screen and hug somebody. It sounds cheesy, but that is what I feel like when I'm reading the surveys. And I suppose in a lot of ways, it's probably the compassion that I wished that I would have had when I was a child and felt such anxiety just about myself and people and the world and my place in it and my body and all kinds of stuff.
Right. And I think that comes across. It sounds very intimate. So I'm not surprised that you imagine talking directly to that person, because that's really how it comes across.
When I get an email from somebody who does get to hear their survey read and they share with me that it had an impact on them, you know, oftentimes they'll say that, you know, I was in the kitchen, all of a sudden I heard you read my survey and I dropped the dishes and just started crying. And it can be this cathartic experience for people sometimes just filling it out, even it not being read on the podcast, just the act of witnessing their own pain by having to put it into a sentence, which is why I think support groups and journaling and podcasting are such great tools for us to pry the icky out of our out of our soul.
Yeah. I know what you mean. I definitely benefited from that a lot hosting this show. Like, I never saw that coming. I thought, I'll do this show. It's a topic that really interests me. And somehow, I think naively, I thought, well, this isn't going to interact too heavily with my stuff. And I think part of that was maybe not realizing how much I had going on in terms of my mental health. I came into the podcast with a depression diagnosis and have since picked up eating disorder diagnosis. And I think, you know, it forced me to look certain things in the eye. You know, it's one thing to have grown up and seen eating disorders in the media and feel a sort of sinking in my stomach that you can feel when something is familiar in a way that makes you uncomfortable. But I think it took hearing the experiences firsthand and being the one asking the questions and bringing those experiences out, that's when I really had to face, okay, this is more familiar than I can explain away.
I know so many people who rolled into a support group to support a loved one and wound up staying for themselves. Mm-hmm. And dealing with this stuff with my mom, it was greatly aided by interviewing guests on my podcast. One in particular that really helped me start to put some pieces together was an interview with a brilliant comedian named Phil Hendry, who I really, really respect. And he was so open about his mom's inappropriateness and how it affected his sexuality. And I think for a lot of us, when we have a caregiver who isn't safe, there's a part of us to survive as a child that says, that's not true. You're throwing them under the bus, and you change the narrative in your brain so that you can survive. And until you consciously change that as an adult, because people can tell you, my ex-wife would tell me all the time, your mom is fucking creepy. I don't like the way she touches you. I don't like the way she talks to you. And you have not dealt with it. It took me 20 years for me to finally be able to say that. And I broke down and started crying. And she said, I've been waiting 20 years for you to say this. But we have to be the ones to finally say, I'm not making this up. I'm not making too big of a deal. And I'm ready to deal with the lava that is coming out of my soul right now. But right. It was the best thing I ever did. It was the best thing I ever did. The most painful, confusing thing I ever did. And especially because covert incest, it's very confusing.
Absolutely. And it's something that is so misunderstood.
So misunderstood. People think that sexual abuse is about being wrestled to the ground, but it's really just about your dignity being taken away. You know, your innocence, you being made to feel unsafe in the world, regardless of, even if the other person didn't know they were hurting you, it's your experience that matters, because this isn't about prosecuting them necessarily. This is about you stopping the prosecution of yourself by shaming yourself.
I'd never quite thought about it like that. And I think you're right that absolutely there always has to be that healing from you. That even if you are in a situation where prosecution is the route for you, there's still ultimately a point where you have to reconcile what's gone on internally, because that's sticking with you, whether they're imprisoned or not.
Yeah, Yeah, and you know, in talking about guests, there was a woman who was a guest early on named Leah McCord, and she talked about incest by her father. And we wrapped the episode up and we were walking down the hall and she said, actually, there's one more thing I'd like to talk about. And we got back on the mic and she said, I want anybody out there to know that if you are being sexually abused, feels good, that does not mean that it's your fault. And I relied on that when I began to untangle my stuff with my mom and really look at the things that I'd brushed aside. And I remembered one time that she gave me a bath and I was like 12 years old. And I was like, I do not need to be in a bath for, you know, having gravel in my knee. But I didn't want to have a discussion about it. You know, I didn't want her to make fun of me for being, you know, shy or whatever it was. And while I'm waiting in the bathtub for her to come, I got an erection. And I felt like the biggest monster. I blamed myself for 40 years that there was something wrong with me. And it took a therapist explaining to me, your mom created a sexually charged environment. And that was just your body responding. It did not mean you wanted that. That was when I stopped punishing myself and started to say, what if there's a different way of looking at this rather than I'm a dirty piece of shit?
And that's massive because I think so many people go through that experience and shit, what else was I going to say?
I do that all the time on the podcast, but it gets edited out.
I know. Honestly, I had a conversation recently in fact, we'll leave this in because it's relevant. Yeah, we edit that out all the time. And I had a conversation with a guest recently where she brought up memory as we were talking about loss beyond, you know, what we think of with bereavement, other types of loss. And I realized I'd never talked about memory issues I have on the podcast. And a lot of that was, it took me so long to link that to my depression that I just thought, okay, this is my fault. It was like the last bit of shame it felt like to unpick of, okay, this is my fault, therefore, how can I own it? And actually, I think a lot of it is due to depression now, looking at it and looking at times where my memory was its worst and seeing that correlation. Yeah, it's tricky. And then combine that with dyslexia. And then as soon as you're having an intense conversation, it can just all go.
I have tremendous shame and anxiety around having a bad memory because I'm afraid that people are going to take it personally, that it means that I don't place importance on them. So it's something I just really, I try to work on, you know, I try to remember as best I can. But, you know, like I was at a playing cards with some friends about a year ago, and this guy was talking about the B-52s and Chrissy Hynde. And I said, oh, I saw the B-52s and Chrissy Hynde. He goes, fuckhead, we were at the concert together. And everybody laughed and I felt so stupid. But I truly, there's just times when my brain just does not absorb what is happening. You know, I'll watch the same documentary twice and not even recall until halfway into it that I've seen this already.
Right. And it's incredible that sometimes this stuff can surprise us because mental health is about what's going on in our brain. And then we get surprised when there's a symptom that relates to it.
Yeah.
But no, that's definitely happened to me. And I've learned to try and find the joy in it. And so actually now one of my favorite really weird pleasures is prompting friends to tell me about things. And it has to be a close friend because like you say, they can be offended, but tell me things that I've forgotten. And it's almost like hearing a story that's been made up about you. And I find myself like giggling along and being like, oh, that does sound like something I would say. And they're like, you did say that.
That's fantastic. I have a friend in my support group who was not sober for much of his daughter's life. And so he does not remember much at all. It was kind of a haze to him. And he has a good relationship with her now. She's an adult. And she was saying, hey, Dad, you remember that time we did such and such? And it was a fond memory. And he said, no, I don't. But give me another one. And she gave him one. He said, give me another one. And he just, it was like his way of going back in time and getting to be there with his daughters, the best that he could salvage from that. And it was really bittersweet for him that he wasn't present with his daughter for this, but he was happy that she remembers it with fondness and that she can share it with him. But it's a great example of how alcoholism and drug addiction affects so much more than, you know, the wrecked car. We're not there. We may be there physically, but we are not there. We're either wrapped up in self or we're hallucinating or, you know, we're checked out. The ripples of untreated mental illness and addiction are so far reaching. I'm sure the trauma that I'm dealing with today, its roots, I'm sure, go back to Ireland and France, you know, the countries where my mom and my dad's people are from.
Right. And I think at times it's so difficult to see those patterns, particularly when those in the generations above us aren't seeing them. You know, we're trying to Right. piece together a jigsaw, but we're missing so many of the pieces.
The thing that I'm really excited about, though, is this sea change of openness and people talking about their struggles now, whether it's on social media or in person and support groups or just friends hanging out with each other. There does seem to be a consciousness change in people actively wanting to stop the cycle of addiction, abuse, neglect, all that shit.
And finding the power to talk about it is so incredible to see. Yes. When people get that spark and they realize, oh, this actually feels good talking about all these things that I felt shame around. It can feel so powerful. And I love to see that. And, you know, out of all the things that have come from the podcasting I do, we've made a lot of progress around mental health education here in the UK and a campaign that I lead, which is so incredible, but can feel hard to contemplate sometimes, the scale of that. And the thing that really, I don't know if it's more digestible or it feels closer to home at times to what I'm doing, but when other people share with me what they've gone on to found listening to this show, you know, the conversations they've gone on to have. And sometimes it's them starting a podcast. I count them. It's been, I think, 8 podcasts now that have written to us and said, oh, we were actually inspired by you. And most of them are not in the UK, which is incredible to try and wrap your head around. But even just the conversations people have, you know, people saying, oh, I listened to this episode with a parent and it was nail biting, but it might have changed our relationship. And
Difficult conversations are the hallmark of growth. I never realized that I was emotionally stunted because I wasn't willing to be uncomfortable in a conversation. I wasn't, because to speak up for our needs or to apologize to somebody is uncomfortable. Mm. But it's amazing what the dividends are once we start taking that leap and either saying, this makes me uncomfortable, or asking, did I make you uncomfortable? If so, I'm, you know, sorry, whatever it may be.
I totally agree with that. And it's interesting, that weird backwardsness at times, that so often it can be the thing that's most uncomfortable is what we most need to talk about. And yet we really struggle with it in that situation. In other situations, I don't know if we do as much. If, you know, you're nervous to get on stage, that doesn't tell you you shouldn't be getting on stage. You can rationalize, no, that's because this is important to me. It's because I care so much. It's because I love this. And I think to an extent, I don't want this taken away from me. So I better do well on this set.
Great, great observation. So true. It is so true. And I think a lot of times the problem is we haven't seen something modeled for us. There's no script. You know, if you've never seen something modeled for you, and you're probably not going to see it in the movies. Certainly if you're a guy growing up in the era I grew up in, it's if something wrong happens, well, you better beat somebody up or shoot them. You know, the answer is to look cool, because then you're going to get the girl. You know, you never see a gangster movie where somebody puts their gun down and starts crying and says, I feel emotionally overwhelmed. You know, it doesn't make for a great movie necessarily, but, you know,
maybe
I suppose
it's
a different
movie.
Though
I would love that, as it would be, of course, such a risk in the commercialized Hollywood world. But I would kind of love that, to get people in with an action film and then halfway through it just shifts and it's about mental health.
Yes. Yeah, that would be funny. I mean, isn't that really the breadth of human experience, though, is the darkness and the light? And I think any good art is beautiful shading of dark and light, so you get the full experience. And I try to have that in episodes of the podcast, specifically in the surveys. you know, to pepper in those ones where there's humor or there's positivity. After doing the podcast for a few years, started to weigh me down because I didn't have any surveys that were light in there. You know, there was the awfulsome moments, which can be funny sometimes, but there weren't happy moments. And there wasn't the loves survey that there is now. And those for me are like Christmas because there's certainly enough heavy shit in there. You know, over 10,000 people have taken the shame and secret survey, and I'm only somewhere around 8,000. I'm about 3 years behind in keeping up with that because it's just, I can't read more than about 10 a week. But the other ones I'm completely caught up with because I love reading them. I'm always asking people, please fill out more of the happy moments and the loves surveys.
We'll start to wrap up. But one thing I'm interested to know if we have this in common, I think for a long time, I felt a lot of shame around what ultimately now I can see as empathy. My ability to connect with other people's pain, I thought was inherently wrong. Like, why can't I relate to people's? Yeah, absolutely. I thought, why is it I can connect to this so easily? And then somebody's happy. And that one's so much more of a struggle. And of course, depression is a big part of the answer. But I kind of think with what you said about what makes us human, I think that's a big part of it too. That maybe we do have more in common with the ways in which we struggle, the emotions that are the hardest, that are the most intense. Maybe they are the easiest to relate to, and that's okay.
I do believe that. I believe that there's a half a dozen primary feelings and emotions that we all share. They're just triggered by different things. You know, one guy, it's, you know, his beautiful house on the ocean slid into the ocean. And another guy, it's his 1977 Dodge Dart blew a gasket and he doesn't have the money to fix it, or, you know, whatever it is. One of the things I wanted to do with the podcast was I wanted to have people who were in the public eye, friends of mine, comedians, actors, musicians, right alongside somebody that nobody's ever heard of, friend from a support group, just somebody off the street. So you could see week in and week out, oh, we're all battling shame, fear of the future, fear that we don't do enough, we don't have enough, and we aren't enough. In one form or another, it really boils down to, I don't have enough, I don't do enough, I'm not enough.
Yeah. And that is why at the end of every episode of this podcast, I say, you are enough. Because that was something that...
Love it.
That I realized had been so transformational for me. I don't think I really realized. It's like so many things. It's like I put it out there and other people connected with it so strongly. And then it almost took that to help me emotionally process it.
Isn't that funny? Isn't that funny? It's so much easier. There's a guy in one of my support groups that says, when I'm mentoring somebody, he tells them what he says, I tell them what to do. And then if it works, I try it.
Oh, that's so funny. But it's so true as well. You know, this idea that like every counselor has a perfect home life. It's not the case.
Yes. And that's another thing I love having on the podcast is having therapists as guests where we can see how human they are, that they fuck up. They have fears, they have issues, but if anything, I think it makes them more effective therapists because they can understand more deeply what somebody else is experiencing, you know, as long as they're not showing up to work loaded, you know, high on meth, you know, that might be an issue.
Yeah, absolutely. That would make for an interesting session, not in the right way.
Yeah, it would be chatty. There would be no silence, which would be nice.
And so as we start to wrap up, if people are really connecting with your experiences, is there anything more you'd like to add in terms of how they can try and come to terms with what's going on for them? You know, whether it's similar to you or completely different.
In general, find your people, find your family. Our families are often not the people that gave birth to us. Sometimes they are, sometimes they're not. But for me, family are people who I trust, who respect me, who I know will be there for me and vice versa. And those are the people that I surround myself with. And that's who I go through life with. I don't go through life alone. I go through life with a herd of people I trust. And, you know, we have a saying, sorry to keep quoting my support group, but we have a saying that stay in the center of the herd, because if you don't, you know, if you've ever seen a documentary on the plains of Africa, you know, the gazelles that get picked off are the ones out on the edges, you know, that aren't in the middle of the herd. And there's safety in numbers and being one of many. To our ego, it's terrifying that we're one of many, because we think that means that we're not special. But being one of many actually allows us to tap into what we have in common, which I think goes back to the days of telling stories in the cave, you know, so that we all can remember that, oh yeah, we really do share a lot and we really are alike. We all laughed at this part of the story and we all got scared at this part of the story. We're all in this together.
So true. And so if people haven't yet caught your show, what would you want to say about it and where can they find it?
It's called the Mental Illness Happy Hour, and you can listen to it on any, whatever podcast device you listen on. And you can go to our website, mentalpod.com. Mentalpod is also the social media handle you can follow us at. But go to mentalpod.com, and there's all kinds of stuff there. You can fill out surveys. You can browse the forum. There's tons of topics in the forum. Yeah. I think that's it. But be nice to yourself. We're uniquely positioned to be our own best friends, and yet we talk to ourselves in a way that if somebody else did it, we'd get a restraining order.
Very true. You're just incredibly quotable, and I love your show. So
it means a lot to me. Yeah, I love chatting with you. Thanks for being such a great advocate, and congrats on the work that you're doing.
Thank you. Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.